Good afternoon. Education Finance Committee will come to order. Today the committee is going to do, we're going to continue on an overview of programs that we have for the benefit of our students. And today is on concurrent enrollment programs, post-secondary enrollment options, advanced placement, and international baccalaureate programs. All things that we have to allow students to accrue college credit while they are still in high school. And so we will be getting overviews on those programs and testimony from a variety of people. But before that, Representative Slocum, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes from January 18th and be comfortable moving a motion of approval?
Thoroughly reviewed and so moved.
Good. We have a motion to approve the minutes. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Slocum. All right. So I want to make sure we have ample time for testimony and questions. So we'll get right down to business. And how I've asked staff to structure today is first we will have Mr. Strom, our House Research staff, to do a quick presentation, just an overview, so everyone, again, is informed on the programs that we have currently in place and a little bit about them. And then we will move on to testifiers from that. So, Mr. Strom, wherever you're comfortable, if you want to do it from your chair, that's just fine.
Madam Chair, that might be most efficient.
Okay.
Members, two documents we'll refer to, and we'll try to keep this as short as possible. In your gray school finance guides, there's a three-page description, I believe starting on page 78, of the dual enrollment programs. So you can glance at that if you want some further information about any of the dual enrollment programs that we're going to talk about, primarily PSEO and concurrent enrollment.
Okay, and members, again, just the gray books that Mr. Strom referenced, they should be in your folders. If you're not, we may have extra on the cart. And page 78 was the page that Mr. Strom referenced.
And, Madam Chair, to go along with that, there's just in your first green sleeve in your folder, there should be three short printouts for you that will provide you just a little bit of history over time about the funding of programs like PSEO and the courses and credits taken. The first of those is titled Traditional Postsecondary Enrollment Options Students, or PSEO Students, by type of school, credits earned, and average cost per credit. And what this shows is from fiscal year 2008 to fiscal year 2015, it shows the number of non-public students at traditional non-public schools, the number of homeschool students, and the number of public school students who are participating in the PSEO program. When we refer to the traditional PSEO program, we're talking about those students that take classes directly from the faculty at the post-secondary institution, usually on the campus of the post-secondary institution. These are the ones that fit that definition of traditional PSEO. Our nomenclature changed a few years ago. We used to use PSEO as the broad heading for all these programs, and more recently the trend has been to call these programs dual enrollment, and then traditional PSEO involving those where the state makes the payment to the post-secondary institution. And you can see that in the very right-hand column, you can see the dollars per year that the state is paying. We've got a list on the following sheet that will show for 1 year what those payments look like to the various post-secondary institutions. But this first sheet, which is laid out landscape style, just shows the pupil counts that are actually going to the higher ed institution for the courses. Shows that there's 759 non-public students, 1,842 homeschool students, 7,575 public school students during the 14-15 year. They earned a total of 167,000 credits with an average credit cost of $190 per credit, and the state paid, instead of paying general education aid to the school districts for those kids, for the portion of time that they were in PSEO, paid $31.8 million directly to the post-secondary institutions. And if you turn to the second page then, which is oriented portrait style, that shows those payments to each of the higher ed institutions that qualified for the 2014-2015 school year. And you can see that same number of credits then, that same 167,000 credits, and which universities and colleges are the recipients of those funds and the credits they provided. And that, as you look up and down that list, you can see that the Minnesota state system, particularly some of the community colleges, are toward the top of that list in terms of the number of credits offered. There are non-public or private colleges as well that qualify for the program, and can the students can take their post-secondary enrollment options classes from those universities or colleges as well. And you can see up and down the list here the amount that go through the traditional PSEO program. So very quickly, Madam Chair, that was the traditional PSEO program. In more recent years, concurrent enrollment programs that often go by the name of the institution that presents them the most common name that's often appropriated just to describe all the programs as things like college in the schools, that's actually the name the University of Minnesota uses for its program, and other state college systems have different names for their programs. But what this sheet does at the top is break down the PSEO, traditional PSEO participants by general demographic groups. And then the bottom half below the light gray shading line there shows the concurrent enrollment pupils, those that qualify for the concurrent enrollment aid is how we're doing this count. And you can see that the numbers in 2008, there were about 17,000 students in concurrent enrollment classes, and now there's about 27,000 as of 2015. Those classes are taught at the high school by teachers that have been that are under the auspices of the higher education institution that's sponsoring the program, and you can see a breakdown of the type of students that by demographic group that are taking those classes. And get a small feel for how those numbers have changed over time. Finally, I'd mention that there's one third way that some of the PSEO dual enrollment courses are provided now, and that's through a contract where the school district simply contracts with the post-secondary institution to provide the course. There are some financial benefits for doing it that way, and as a result, those won't show up as either concurrent enrollment or PSEO on our student count, but instead those are a contract arrangement. So, for example, I believe the Burnsville School District contracts to provide some courses with Normandale Community College. The reason that the district may enter into a contract is it may be a financially better situation for both parties for them to do that. And I don't want to go too much into the detail of that given all of the things on the agenda today, but basically the PSEO program, the way that works is 88% of the basic formula allowance is paid on a pro rata basis to the higher ed institution for the period of time that the student's there, and the general education money then is prorated for the portion of time that the student's at the high school, and the general education money is larger than the sum that's paid for the PSEO hours. And so what happens in these contract arrangements is the district hangs on to all of the general education money and counts the student for purposes of the funding formulas as a full-time student enrolled at the high school, and then contracts with the post-secondary institution as the service provider to deliver that class, and often it's delivered in the regular method at the post-secondary institution. So it looks just like a regular PSEO course taught on the college campus, but the funding works slightly different. So in a nutshell, Madam Chair, those are the three programs under PSEO or dual enrollment. There's also, I believe Mr. Kennedy has copied the budget pages, and there's in those budget pages there's a description of the AP and IB, the Advanced Placement and International Baccalaureate programs, and some student participation rates and other things there as well.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And just a quick question, the contract arrangements that you mentioned, is that data captured anywhere that we would know how many schools are making those kinds of arrangements?
Madam Chair, I'll double-check on that. I'm not sure if we have all those contracts captured or not, because the school board, of course, has the authority, if it's got the agreement from its faculty, to contract for any services that it wants to, including as long as it's provided by the licensed personnel. So I'll double check with MDE to see if we have a number on that. We may not have statewide numbers on that, but we certainly know some of the instances where that happens.
Okay. And one other question, then I'll go to you, Representative Devney. The demographic information, the other point that I'd be interested in knowing about, and we can maybe learn a little bit by knowing where the credits are at the institutions will give us some sense, but do we know geographically how the student population that's taking advantage of these programs, how it's distributed throughout the state?
Madam Chair, yes, we could provide you with those numbers, both for concurrent enrollment and PSEO. We can show the home district so one can get a sense of the place the student is coming from that's in the programs.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the topic of today's hearing. As you know, this is an area that I've got some passion in and have worked in my time in the legislature. And it, I think maybe this is a question to Mr. Strom. It didn't occur to me until today that the missing rigorous course-taking opportunity in today's discussion and how we usually talk about these programs is Project Lead the Way, which can also lead to college credit being earned in the high school. And I guess my question to Mr. Strom is, you know, does that not fall under our PSEO statute? Because we've got AP and IB, which aren't dual enrollment, that do fall under PSEO. Here's Project Lead the Way that is more like dual enrollment, but it's not, I don't think, in there. And then I guess a question to the chair about, given your interest in this area, maybe a suggestion you consider bringing Project Lead the Way in to talk about their activities and locations and demographics and all the same issues.
Yes, and I think that's a good idea, and then I'll defer to Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, I'm embarrassed that I'll need to do some checking on Project Lead the Way. I'm not familiar with that title in that form, and I'll get back to you as soon as I know something.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Strom.
Thank you for raising it. Thank you, Representative Dabney. All right, any other questions for Mr. Strom before we move on to our testifiers? All right, and we'll try to allow questions after each testifier. But I'm going to keep an eye on the clock, and if I need to rearrange that, just because I want to make sure we hear from everybody and then try to have opportunity for questions. So Joe Nathan, Mr. Nathan with Center for School Change. Welcome, Mr. Nathan. If you please just state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Joe Nathan. I direct the Center for School Change. I have been an urban public school teacher and administrator, PTA president. I have been very actively involved in nationally and here in Minnesota at the school, community, and policy levels. Our children all attended the St. Paul Public Schools, and my wife recently retired after 33 years as a public school teacher here in St. Paul. What I'd like to do today is to offer four things for the committee's consideration. We'd be glad to respond to questions. First, a brief history of the effort both nationally and here in Minnesota to offer opportunities for high school students to earn college credit while they're still in high school. Secondly, a so what? Why do we care about all of this? Why has it been at certain times quite contentious both in this building and other places around the United States? So how has it been contentious, and what are some positive and what are some concerning ways that people have responded? And then finally, a brief overview of what the legislature might want to consider this and in this year in terms of strengthening and improving the program so that more youngsters participate and participate successfully. And I will be suggesting some ways that we can move some of these ideas ahead without spending any additional public funds, as well as some possible expenditures. So, in brief, a summary that I hope you have a copy of the testimony, one-page summary that provided to the committee staff. But in brief, in the 1950s, the College Board created the Advanced Placement Program, AP is commonly known. That was a testing program. The idea was that there were certain youngsters who were ready for more challenging classes. There are trade-offs for all of these programs. I want to comment that Representative Dabney has been a longtime advocate of college in the schools. There's a key difference between college in the schools, as the University of Minnesota calls it, and concurrent enrollment, as the Minnesota State College and University System, or now Minnesota State, calls it. And the key difference between these programs is that the credit that a student earns in AP comes down to how well she or he does on one day and one test, whereas in concurrent enrollment or college in the schools, it depends much more on the real-world atmosphere, which is how well do you do throughout the entire class. And that's a key difference. There are major differences between these different kinds of programs, and if you want some of the details, we can get into that. In any case, in 1968, Dr. Kenneth Clark The gentleman who was cited repeatedly in Brown versus Board of Education urged in a Harvard Education Review that because of his frustration and the frustration of literally millions of people, that there be new opportunities to have public education outside the control of school districts. And yesterday you heard an excellent presentation about charters, but if you look at that 1968 article, that's what Kenneth Clark was encouraging, that there be new opportunities outside the control of local districts. And one might see PSEO as a great example of what he was recommending in 1968. 1983, the Minnesota Business Partnership recommended that people be allowed to move across district lines to attend different kinds of public schools, district schools, and they also recommended what has come to be known as PSEO, the idea that initially 11th and 12th graders would be allowed to take full or part-time courses on college campuses. That was and has been, just as you heard yesterday, a bipartisan effort. It was proposed by Rudy Perpich. It was strongly endorsed by Governor Al Quie. It was hugely supported by Representative Connie Levi, and this never would have passed in 1985 without strong bipartisan support. So I want to, and there are several people in this room who were here then, and I've been working on this for the last 30 years. This is one of those shining examples praised by the National Governors Association 1985 and report that I can share with you, where we have had bipartisan support. So, again, wanting to be respectful of your time, this passed in 1985. There were efforts to repeal it in 1986. It was, in fact, revised. The School Board Association came up with an excellent recommendation about how to improve it in 1986. We can talk about that if you're interested. There were, between 1987 and 2012, various changes. Some of the changes included the school districts coming to the legislature and asking for money to create more advanced placement and international baccalaureate programs. In 2012, there was a considerable controversy, and the legislature decided to expand PSEO to allow youngsters to take courses in career and technical beginning in the 10th grade. 2014, we had a great debate about what some of us call the gag rule, which said that colleges couldn't tell kids that they could save money by taking PSEO courses. The legislature decided to change that in part, but instead decided to require fundamentally that high schools tell families and kids that the program existed and some of the details. We did some research in early 2015, found that most school districts were not doing that. The commissioner encouraged the school districts, and I want to pay particular attention and credit to Gary Amoroso from the Superintendents Association, and Fred Nolan of Rural Education Association, who worked very hard to encourage school districts to comply with the state regulation on that. In 2015, we worked together to increase funds for college in the schools, and then we had to deal with the Higher Learning Commission, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. So that's a very brief summary of how all of this has evolved. Last year, Representative Jared Nornes and his colleagues expanded the information that was available, so pretty soon students and families will be able to know what are the acceptance policies of dual credit. So this has been a continuing evolution since 1985. Briefly, what does the research say? There is a one-page summary that I've attached and distributed to you. It's on the back of a handout that looks like this. It shows this is MDE and Minnesota State College and University System, now Minnesota, Minnesota State is how they're calling themselves now. And this shows 30 to 40 point increases for youngsters who participate in either college in the schools or PSEO in terms of graduation rates. Some have said this is called MDE, statewide four-year graduation rates. We can see for African-American kids, for example, that in 2012-13, 57.8% of the African-American kids in the state graduated in 4 years, but for African-American kids who took either one PSEO or college in the schools course, it was 88%, a huge increase. For every single racial and economic group, huge increase. Now, some people say, well, Joe, those are the kids who are inclined to graduate from high school anyway. On the back of this piece of paper is another one-page summary, and briefly, Columbia University found that males, low-income, low-achieving, and high school students all appear to benefit from participation in dual credit to a greater extent, and it goes on to talk about what's called academic momentum. So earning college credit actually changes the way that kids think about themselves, and last year, Representative Erickson welcomed youngsters from Princeton who came in to talk about how their view of themselves had changed because they suddenly saw that they could actually earn college credit, and it changed the way they think about themselves. So this has been a huge and important tool. Anyway.
Mr. Nathan, I'm not sure we have the handout that you're referring to, so if we need to make copies, we'll make sure that a page makes copies and gets them for the committee members. I'm sorry.
I apologize.
Please continue.
Representative Dabney referred to Project Lead the Way. There's a one-page summary of all of these different programs, AP, IB, college and the schools. It can get complicated. There are trade-offs. There are advantages and disadvantages that we can talk about. Where does that leave us? Well, there have been two fundamental responses to all of this. First has been a very constructive response. A number of high schools and charter public schools around the state have responded by increasing the number of advanced placement, college in the schools, Project Lead the Way, CLEP, courses offered right in the high school. That's been terrific. And the vast majority of youngsters, as this handout shows, there's a very fine report that the state legislature asked the Minnesota Department of Education to do. This shows that the vast majority of kids who participate in various forms of dual credit do so in the high school, and that's fine. That's a great place for many of the kids. There are some kids who are ready to be on a college campus or, more recently, to take a course via computer, which is also possible by PSEO. But as you can see from this handout, the vast majority of kids participate in these courses right in the high school. And as some of you heard in testimony last year, it's been a fabulous experience for a lot of high school teachers to be able to work collaboratively with college faculty to offer these courses right in the high school. So that's been a very positive response. On the negative side, unfortunately, some high schools, not all, some school districts, not all, some charters, not all, have decided to discourage kids from participating in PSEO by weighting grades and the grade point average differently. So kids get more credit for participating in a course offered in the high school compared to a course offered on a college campus. I think that that's unfortunate. We can talk more about that. As I mentioned, we did some research that showed that 90% of the high schools, district and charter, were not giving kids all of the details about PSEO, and to the credit of the Commissioner of Education, and I've mentioned already MREA, MASA, and the Charter School Association, there was a very intensive effort to make sure that that was happening, and we went back to check, and in fact, that much of that has been rectified. So there have been both positive and negative responses. Now we are faced with a situation with the Higher Learning Commission, which you're going to hear more about. Some of us are deeply concerned about the Higher Learning Commission. One of the pieces of material in this handout that has the MDE standards for your graduation rates is a letter that 25 educators and community groups sent to the Commissioner Rosenstone on May 31st of last year asking for a meeting with the senior staff of the Minnesota State College and University System to talk about this. Unfortunately, that opportunity was not made available. People were told, we'll go talk to the individual institutions, but the teacher unions were meeting regularly with the senior staff of the Minnesota institutions, which was fine, but people from the state associations, the charter schools, people from the state, for example, council, Minnesotans of African Heritage, and a variety of other people are also asking for that opportunity, and unfortunately that opportunity has not been made available. We asked for that opportunity because the Minnesota State College and University System announced quietly last spring that it was increasing the cost for college and the schools for many small high schools, both district and charter, 100%. That is to say, the cost was going from $1,500 to $3,000. We wanted to talk about that a little bit. The cost was not going to increase for all high schools, depending on the number of credits. We wanted to talk about that. We wanted to talk about what's called tested experience, which was one of the opportunities. Unfortunately, we're still waiting for a positive response. We did get a negative response to this letter. Finally, what does all of this mean for the legislature this year? Well, I mentioned that there are five key themes: options, opportunity, empowerment, collaboration, and courage. It has taken courage of legislators of both parties to work together. It has taken courage for legislators to say, we're going to try to put what's best for kids. So what does this mean? Well, I think that there are opportunities to expand information without spending more public money. I think that there are new opportunities that ought to be available for high school faculty. Some people are going to be asking you to give money to a particular system to do teacher training. The legislature has often said we want to have competition for money. We don't want to just give money to a particular institution. I think that's a very good approach. We can talk more about that. I think we can provide incentives for both high school and colleges and universities to work more closely together. And I think that we can retain terrific principles that this legislature has adopted, which have been recognized throughout the United States by other governors, by the President of the United States, Those principles remain options, opportunity, empowerment, collaboration, and courage. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Nathan. Representative Scott, you had a question.
Just real quickly, thank you for your presentation. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it true that on the gag rule, is there a time limit on when that expires? Is there like a five-year time period, and then the gag rule goes back into force?
That's my understanding.
Mr. Nathan.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative, that's my understanding.
Madam Chair, what would be the rationale for not making that permanent? For not the gag rule, but for making sure that these parents and students know what options are available to their kids. What would be the rationale for not making that known to them?
Mr. Nathan.
Madam Chair, Representative, we had an extensive conversation about that in 2014, and a number of community and educator and parent and other groups urge that this be removed, and it will be one of the recommendations that some of us will be making this year. We think that there are a number of things that need to be done. Certainly, family information is one of them. But we also want to make sure there are more opportunities for educators.
Okay, thank you, Representative Scott. Other questions for Mr. Nathan? All right, Mr. Nathan, thank you very much. And you may want to stick around in case someone has a question for you later, if that's all right.
Thank you.
All right, next we have Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs at Minnesota State, Mr. Anderson. All right, and you have, all right, and with you, Connie Gores, President of Southwest Minnesota State, is that correct? All right, very good. Welcome to both of you. And if you would each just introduce yourselves and your affiliation for the record, and we welcome your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. And my name is Ron Anderson, and I serve as the Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs with Minnesota State.
And my name is Connie Gores, and I'm the President of Southwest Minnesota State University. Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to have you both with us today.
Great. Thank you. First, I want to begin by thanking you all for letting us have this opportunity to share with you the work we've been undertaking over the last 9 to 12 months. And I want to begin by just reaffirming the commitment of Minnesota State to ensuring the continued growth and strengthening of our concurrent enrollment programs across the state. You have in your packet a double-sided one-page summary that I'm going to walk through just some highlights of that speak to some of the issues that we've been addressing over the last year. As you know, the Higher Learning Commission clarified its expectations relative to faculty credentials back in 2015, and then last late spring, early summer, developed a an extension application process for institutions to request additional time to meet those credentials requirements. Initially, the credential requirements were to be in effect September 1st, 2017. Minnesota State, on behalf of all 33 programs offered by our colleges and universities, submitted that application. We submitted a single application with data from every institution, but had two specific requests of the Higher Learning Commission. One, that they treat Minnesota State system as a single entity for purposes of a common decision on the extension timeline, and two, that they recognize our need and desire to continue to bring faculty into the concurrent enrollment programs over the next 5 years who may not yet have reached that credential threshold. Both of those components, along with our overall application, was approved, so we have an extension until September 1st of 2022. That gives us now just over 5.5 years to work with our partner districts to ensure that all of those faculty teaching within these programs are appropriately credentialed. Last spring, as we were preparing for that application process, we worked with the K-12 districts to examine the credentials of all the faculty that are currently teaching within our concurrent enrollment programs. That review, the data of which were included in our application, reflected that 24% of the current faculty already meet the credential requirements, the other 76% requiring anywhere between 1 and 18 additional graduate credits. We worked throughout the summer and fall with faculty leadership both at our colleges and our universities as well as the K-12 system to develop a plan for how we would go about assisting high school teachers in obtaining the appropriate credentials. That was part of our application to the Higher Learning Commission. And as you'll see outlined on the overview, there are really three main components that we're working in earnest on this spring semester with the intent to get those things in place by early summer so that folks can begin to develop their professional development plans and identify the most appropriate route for them to take. The three components I'd call your attention to, one is the expansion of the availability of graduate coursework across our seven state universities. We have graduate programs, as you know, in a number of disciplines, and we've been looking at how to best structure course offerings for working teachers, and that involves looking at online opportunities, potential cohort models, summer-based programs, potential evening or weekend cohorts as well. The second component is around the portfolio review process that would allow us to award credit for learning that the high school faculty have obtained outside of the classroom. As we've discussed over the last couple of years within the context of faculty credentialing, we know that many of our high school faculty have extensive content knowledge and expertise at the graduate level. A portfolio review process then allows us the opportunity to document and assess that competency and award graduate credit then, which would count towards the credentialing requirement. And then the third component that we're working with the faculty leadership on exploring is the possibilities around team teaching. That does not result in a credential change, but through team teaching, it would be possible for myself, if I were a high school instructor, to work with Dr. Gores as the university instructor. If we truly are sharing the development and the delivery of the course, the fact that she is credentialed meets the credentialing requirement and we are allowed to provide that course. So that's the third component that we're looking at. I wanted to also let you know that we have developed, in response to the 2015 legislation, advisory committees that are active in all of our programs. We have just over 400 members on those advisory committees, and 61% of those coming from the secondary institutions, and then the 39% coming from the post-secondary. So we've been very intentional about focusing our work, our consultation and communication at the local levels where these programs exist. So working with the local advisory councils, the college or university programs, and the K-12 partners. So at this stage, Dr. Gores is going to speak with you a little more about our tested experience and then also address the pricing structure questions that have been arising as well.
Thank you, Ron. Thank you. And thank you, Chair Lewin and representatives for being here and friend for your service. The topic of concurrent enrollment is very important. It's specifically at my institution at Southwest Minnesota State University. It was interesting to hear that some of the history on concurrent enrollment, because we started our concurrent enrollment program in 1984-85. So we were the first, I think, in the state. And we have actually the longest continually running concurrent enrollment program in Minnesota. And just as a context, before I talk about tested experience and so on, might be helpful to give a little context. We have 5,346 unduplicated students in the program, and we have 112 high schools that we work with. I can give you other information as well. One of the things we've looked at real seriously within our system is tested experience, and what does it mean, and how are we going to be working with that? And one of the provisions in our comprehensive plan for meeting the HLC requirements is to provide opportunities to award graduate-level credit to high school teachers who elect to demonstrate graduate-level learning and experience through a portfolio process. So we are in the process of working with our faculty members on that process now, and what will that look like? And how will that all play out? We convened a work group that drafted a framework for the use of this tested experience to qualify faculty members to meet the qualification requirements, and we'll continue to revise this framework and seek additional review from campuses and concurrent enrollment advisory boards. So that's the tested experience piece. Unified pricing structure, why the change? You might be asking about that. We actually, a couple of years ago, had a work group that worked on this extensively for over a year, and it was to ensure that the concurrent enrollment programs can offer high-quality, NAICP-accredited programs These programs must be financially sustainable. Many of our programs currently have a substantial gap between the program expenses and the revenues. And this then creates a situation in which our state colleges in particular are effectively subsidizing concurrent enrollment at the expense of other students. The fees only cover the direct costs of offering high-quality concurrent enrollment programs. For our colleges and universities to continue offering these valuable programs, you would, I'm sure, agree, they must be financially sustainable. And so the changes that we put into effect, they've been shared with advisory boards during the fall and then this winter of 2016 for additional review and consideration. So we're working with them on that. So you might wonder, what does the new pricing structure look like? Well, the unified pricing structure only allows our state colleges and universities, again, to cover the direct costs they incur for offering the high-quality concurrent enrollment programs. There's one for the universities, and then there's one for the colleges. And at the universities, the fee will be $3,300 per mentor-mentee relationship. So we work with our faculty members are the mentors and work directly with them, the mentees or the high school teachers. So this is $3,300 per mentor-mentee relationship, per course, per term, with the option of a per-student charge for courses with 30 students or more. So there are a couple pieces to this. This is a three-year phased-in process, and we start this in fiscal year 18. So fiscal year 18, 19, and 20, so a three-year phase. On the college side, it's a $3,000 per mentor-mentee relationship per course, per term, and they have a five-year phase, and that is fiscal year 18, 19, 20, and 21, I guess in 22. Yeah. So there are two different pieces to that. And then full implementation for the entire system will be by the year 2022. I should add, a number of our universities, mine included, are already very close to or at this $3,300 per mentor-mentee relationship. So that's what we currently are basically following at this point in time and have been for a while anyway. Okay.
Concludes your testimony?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Anderson, I need some clarification because I'm recalling the joint hearing we had with the Higher Learning Commission, and I thought what those gals emphasized was that Minnesota state institutions would not be lose accreditation based on the presentation. That I think they were looking at this as a message to our concurrent enrollment that like a waiver wouldn't have to be applied for one thing, because they were not going to punish on the accreditation side. And you know what bothers me about some of this is that I see it as a revenue generator. Not that I don't find value in the recommendations that are being made, and I've had conversations with you about this, but did we really have to go to the waiver to accomplish this, even though I maybe Representative Nornes recalls, but I'm pretty sure they said there would be no loss of accreditation of those schools in the Minnesota state system if we didn't take immediate action on this. So, I'm bothered a little bit by what they said in that presentation and by the steps that have been taken since, leading me to think that maybe this is, you know, just another way to raise revenue. Besides, I don't think accreditation anymore is as valuable as it used to be. I think it's changed in many ways. How many of your colleges are accredited, I'm not sure, but I think, you know, I need better clarification. So I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but that's my confusion. So, Mr. Anderson.
Vice Chancellor.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, a few comments I would make. When the Higher Learning Commission staff testified, I believe that was in the fall of 2015, at that point they did not envision a waiver or an extension process. They had a hard stop date of September 1st of 17. Because of the conversation here in Minnesota, at least my personal opinion on this, as well as feedback from other states, that led them to reconsider that hard stop, and that led to the development of a process for seeking an extension of that timeline. What was said, what I recall from that conversation and subsequent conversations we've had with the Higher Learning Commission, is that the institution's accreditation, you're remembering the same as I am, that she said we would not be pulled from institutions based on this criteria alone. The reality for our institutions is that they are on anywhere between a 7 and a 10 year review cycle for accreditation, depending on which accreditation pathway they are on. And this will be part of those reviews, reviewing the faculty credentials. It has always been part of the review, but the statements that were made by the president of the Higher Learning Commission was that that alone would not result in the sanctioning or the removal of accreditation. Relative to the impact it has on our institutions, the regional accreditation that is provided by HLC is necessary in order for any institution to participate in federal financial aid programs. So it is a significant critical aspect of our institution's functioning that we need to protect and retain. But the reality of when those reviews will occur on a particular campus is dictated by the time of their review cycle. So some institutions will be up for review in 2022, others will be 23, 24, and so on. If I might, I'd like to ask Dr. Gores to speak a bit to this because she serves as a consultant evaluator with the Higher Learning Commission and is part of the teams that actually go out and make these visits.
I do. And also, thank you, sir, Chairman. Also, in fall of 14, we had, SMSU, had our 10-year accreditation visit. And even in fall of 14, they were reviewing the concurrent enrollment credentials, and they visited three different schools, high schools, during that, I think it was three, when they were on our campus. They had, in fact, had a specific person who that was their responsibility on their team. So even then, they were looking at these sorts of things. And there's no question that there's a, how can I put this, a focus on this sort of thing now. There are 7 regional accrediting agencies across the United States, and all other 6 have had this requirement in place for a while. We've had it in place for a while, too, but HLC has just decided they're finally going to enforce this intentionally and hold us to this. So did that help? Is that helpful?
Representative Erickson.
Oh, I know, Madam Chair, I'm probably far afield here, but I just have issues with this accreditation. I was on a team in my school several years ago now, but it was so costly and time-consuming. I can't imagine what you go through, and I don't know what difference it makes if this is the federal government again, putting their pressure on you. I think that's a travesty, and I hope that changes because I'm not sure that that's a value to our students, and they ultimately are those for whom we do this concurrent enrollment, PSEO, AP, IB, et cetera, and then send them off to you. And we want them to become great citizens and well-educated. But this, I don't know. I'm just troubled by how this has all transpired. And I have worked with Mr. Anderson, and I appreciate the movement we're making forward. But I don't think any of this had to happen. Again, federal government, get out of our way.
I don't know if you wanted to comment or you want to go to the next question.
Next question.
Okay. Wise man. Representative Nornes.
I just wanted to add maybe 2 cents. I remember that hearing as well and have had thoughts about, again, some group, in this case the Higher Learning Commission, attempting to do something. It seems like they've run out of the things to do, so this is now the latest thing that makes their position relevant. The accreditation, I understand that, and that's the good role. That's what they should be doing. But the hearing was very clear that this is a very good program. It's got a very good track record. There's nothing wrong with it. So we're trying to fix something that doesn't need fixing, and it just seems to be adding complication to a lot of people's lives. And I think it can naturally happen with teachers willingly going back getting a doctorate or a master's if they desire to do that. But so that's probably not going to be the case. I should add, in the area that I represent, we have a regional pilot going on that was funded through about a $3 million grant from the state, which allows the high school, in this case Morehead State University, a number of factors, number of players to encourage this. And there's a stipend so that teachers are encouraged to be a part of this, particularly those that are close to retirement. So I think we have sort of a solution, but again, we're spending $3 million to accomplish that. So, again, I share Representative Sandra Erickson's concerns. So, thanks.
Thank you, Representative Erickson, and Norness, for raising those concerns. I think those are shared by many of us who have been involved, and there was a joint hearing on this and that. And I don't know if there's anyone from the Higher Learning Commission in the audience. If you are and you wish to come down, feel free. But I had a couple of questions either for Vice Chancellor or Dr. Gores. And I know, and we had the chance to meet for you to kind of fill me in on prior to the hearing about all the things you mentioned you're working on, and the portfolio review process is, I think, one that we're all interested in, if that could be helpful in terms of that you mentioned 76% of the teachers that don't meet the qualifications that the Higher Learning Commission has established. Do you know, will the Higher Learning Commission have to approve that process, or what you determine in terms of granting a credit for experience and other things to individuals? Is that something that they have to be involved in, or is that something that would remain with the institutions of Minnesota State?
Madam Chair, there is not an approval process through the Higher Learning Commission for that. What would be expected is that when they do site visits of our graduate of our institutions, the expectation is that we have consistent processes developed, but that is to us to define. And what they would be looking for was to see that you do indeed have a process and you're following it. But in terms of approval, the extension of the time frame is the only approval that we needed to seek from them. And we have described to them in telephone conversations prior to submitting that the approach that we're taking. And so they are fully aware of that, but there is no formal approval required anymore.
Thank you. And do you have any estimate of, again, that 76% of our teachers who may be interested, what percentage of that may be good candidates for this? Maybe there just would be a few credits shy of what they need. And then what would be the cost to those teachers for this?
Sure. Madam Chair, on the review that we did of the credentials, as I mentioned earlier, we saw a wide range of gap, if you will, in the number of graduate credits that are needed. It's difficult to say I wouldn't expect that in any consistent manner that it'll be a uniform distribution of how folks meet that, either from coursework or through the portfolio review. I would suspect that people that are quite close may very well have the competencies and the content knowledge needed and be able to use the portfolio review process. We anticipate that for many people it would be a combination of the two, unless someone had a particular personal desire to do the graduate coursework, which is certainly their prerogative. So it's difficult to know exactly where folks are going to determine to go with that. That is a decision that's left up to the individual high school faculty member as they look at their own background and think about the kinds of experiences that they've had and the knowledge that they have acquired outside of the classroom to determine how much of that would fit into a portfolio review process. So we have an estimate of the number. We know the number of pure credits if we look solely at the gap in the credits, and that is just under 9,000 credits statewide for the 1,400 faculty members that teach in our programs. But we don't anticipate that that's the number of credits that would actually be taken to meet the full credential requirements.
Thank you. But let's say for the sake of argument, everyone had to take those credits, 9,000. What would that add up to?
Madam Chair, if we take that nearly 9,000 credits and multiply it by the average graduate tuition rate, it comes to just a little over $3,334,000. Say $335,000, assuming that all of those were obtained via graduate courses.
Thank you. Representative Slocum.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Loon. I'm curious as to, from all the testifiers who have testified to this point, is whether all regional accreditation associations use the same rules. Is everybody playing by the same rules?
Vice Chancellor Anderson or Dr. Coates?
Madam Chair, I'll defer to President Gores.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Loon, Representative. Yes, they are. It's my understanding that all seven are playing by the, have the same kind of requirements.
Representative Slocum.
Could we also hear from Dr. Nathan, please?
Sure. Mr. Nathan, if you want to come forward. Perhaps we can grab a chair from the end here.
Over here. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'd be glad to submit for the record, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be glad to submit for the record or a study that was done by the Midwest Consortium on Higher Education in cooperation with the Education Commission of the States last year. I have an email from the Director of Policy Research who says the answer to that question is no, they do not all have the same, and that there are a number of state regional associations that do not have the requirements that have been imposed by an unelected non-governmental agency on the state of Minnesota 19. I've also attempted to have a conversation with some other people within the Minnesota State College and University system to discuss this and to share this report. And so far, unfortunately, I've not been given the opportunity to do that. But the report is available. The email is available. The answer to the question, according to the research done by the Education Commission of the States and the Midwest Consortium on Higher Education Compact, is no. Also, there is interest in Washington, D.C. at the highest levels of Congress in reviewing this. So one of the recommendations that I will be making and some of us will be making over the next several months is for Minnesota to take a very careful look at this and to look at a variety of opportunities. Do we need to really spend all this money? I want to just point out that we have a representative of the Roseville School District, which has been doing a lot of work on this, and that a number of school districts and community organizations would really like to have an extended conversation about the costs associated with the new Minsky expectations and the pricing structure. I realize that's beyond the scope of the conversation today, but thank you for the question.
Thank you. Representative Slocum?
I'm good now. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And being new to this committee, I'm just now learning that there's this Higher Learning Commission, and it's not a government agency. And how did it come about, and who sanctioned it, and how's it paid for? And tell me a little bit more about it. I don't know who wants to. I don't know if even staff wants to do that, or the people at the table. But
okay,
or Dr. Nathan. I don't know who somebody.
Dr. Loon, Chair Loon, Representative. So I'll just give you the knowledge that I have. There's seven regional accrediting agencies within the United States, and I'm blanking on the oversight group that
CHEA.
Yep. Yes. Council of
Higher Education Accreditation.
Higher Accreditation Body. Okay. And in order to be for institutions, as Vice Chancellor Anderson said, in order to be for institutions to be able to give federal money, Title IV aid to students, Pell Grants, work study, loans, we have to then be accredited by one of these regional accrediting bodies. It's been in place for years. Not sure how many years, but it's been in place for many years. And we're members then of the Higher Learning Commission. We institutions are members of the Higher Learning Commission.
Representative Scott.
Yeah, Madam Chair. So how did it come into existence, and who funds it? Do you pay into the organization as members, and that's how it's funded solely, or does the federal government give money to it, or?
Vice Chancellor?
Madam Chair, yes, the institutions do pay for those memberships, but I am not certain as to whether or not there's additional funding from elsewhere. But I do know we have a component there.
Madam Chair, so did it fall out of thin air, Big Bang Theory, or who created this thing? I don't know if staff know. I guess I'm inquisitive, but about how it came to be.
It's a good question. Dr. Nathan, do you have something?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, some of you remember about 15 years ago that we had a similar situation where another unelected body, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, was trying to tell every high school in the United States, public, private, and parochial, how to operate high schools. They were operating as the great school board in the sky. And they literally were telling high schools all over the state of Minnesota, including, I remember, one in Princeton, in Representative Eric's district, that they could not offer a course for college credit when it was, everybody has agreed it was an appropriate course. We had a 2.5-year battle, which we ultimately won, to challenge the National Collegiate Athletic Association to say, you know, you can regulate colleges and universities if you want, but don't tell high schools how to operate. That's not how the system works. We were ultimately successful. Some of us have advocated for our national challenge. I want to commend several members of this committee for encouraging members of Congress to look into this, and there has been an agreement on some members of Congress from both political parties to take a look at this during the higher education reauthorization. This is literally an unelected organization that is imposing what could be millions of dollars. And I want to go back to the chair's comments. When the executive director of the Higher Learning Commission testified at a joint hearing last year, she readily acknowledged that what was happening in Minnesota was wonderful. She called it a national model. And yet we are being asked, we, the taxpayers of Minnesota, are being asked to spend literally millions of dollars. So we will have some legislative recommendations and some other recommendations about how we might proceed.
Representative Scott?
So I'm assuming, thank you, Madam Chair, that this must have been a creation of Congress at some point. I mean, this is interesting to me, but thank you.
Well, and I will ask staff to perhaps do a little research on that, and perhaps at the next committee meeting we can have an answer to that question. I appreciate it. Good question. Did you wish to comment further? Or? No. Okay. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Scott. I feel your pain. Having been involved when all of this a couple of years ago was developing, the first thing a number of us asked ourselves and each other was, where are the touch points? You know, I'm being asked to step forward and impact a process, and you do what you normally do. If it's the school board making a decision, who's on the school board? When's the elections? You start doing that sort of analysis, or Congress, or, you know, anybody. They're a thing unto themselves. They are unaccountable. I could certainly say arrogant. If you catch me after hours with an adult beverage, I might say stupid. But at the end of the day, I'm practical, and after kicking these people and kicking this issue, I think what we need to focus on now is how do we assure that dual credit opportunities continue to be available to Minnesota kids. And I think that goes then to how do we assist these teachers who may be better teachers than higher education instructors, more skilled, that's the stupid part, more skilled and more experienced as instructors to become compliant so that the institutions in the state can maintain their accreditation, because college students require institutions to be accredited in order for them to get any form of federal aid. So that accreditation thing kind of matters. And I'm as frustrated as you're learning to be and have been for a long time, but I think where we need to focus now is how do we make sure that our teachers are getting access to the programs, the coursework that they need to comply with this so that they can continue to provide these opportunities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney. Do any of you wish to comment?
Madam Chair, I'll just make a brief comment. One of the states in the Midwest that Dr. Anderson referred to that raised a storm of protest, in addition to Minnesota, was Indiana. And we have been in contact with Indiana. And you know who occupies the vice president position in the United States at this point, or tomorrow, actually, tomorrow. There have been conversations. And I think that we need, my recommendation to Congress and to others and to this body is that we pursue a simultaneous strategy of trying to provide more opportunities for faculty, more opportunities for families, and that on the one level, as Representative Dabney suggests, and on a second level, that we do exactly what a number of you did last year, which was to push hard for members of Congress to challenge this. And it is my fervent belief that thanks to people from both the Democratic, DFL, and Republican Party who challenged the Higher Learning Commission from this and a number of other states, they, as Dr. Anderson pointed out, they did provide 5 years to get to this. And I think we need to think very carefully about how we're going to spend money over the next 5 years, because it's not a certain deal that this is going to stay the way it is.
Thank you. Representative Juergens. There you are.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This has been a great conversation, and I don't mean to derail it, but I have more of a question, changing gears a little bit more along the lines of a student experience. And I want to thank all of our testifiers for being here today. And as a proud graduate of Southwest Minnesota State University, especially President Gores for making the trip up from Marshall. I had the opportunity to travel through Marshall last summer. We stopped for lunch at the Wooden Nickel and had just a great hamburger there. So my question to whoever wants to answer is, when the high school students are taking this coursework, are they given full access to the university as far as the library, student centers, athletic events, things like that? I'm just kind of curious about the experience that they have.
Dr. Barr.
Madam Chair, Representative Juergens. Yes, actually, they have full access. They're required to have full access, and as part of NACEP accreditation, the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Programs, we have to have, they have to be given full access. For instance, we give them an ID card, a student's ID card, so they can have access to the library, everything on campus. They also have access remotely so that they can be a Mustang even though they're not fully on campus. And I guess one thing I'll point out is that, so in our 5,346 students who are taking our classes at 112 different schools, they get college credit. Their high school teachers work directly with our university faculty members, and then they get a university credit so that they can take that, they can come to us, they can go to any other university, and that credit carries with them. All of them, reduce their time to degree by being able to take these classes, and they reduce their overall, it helps families tremendously because the overall cost, yes, of their education. So there are all sorts of success stories that I'd be happy to share at some point privately if you want to know that. But, yes, they have exactly the same kinds of opportunities. They don't live in the residence halls, of course, so they don't have maybe some of the experiences you might have had. They might not know about the Wooden Nickel, but they might. They might not have imbibed in the same way that you did, but when you were there recently.
Representative Juergens.
And with that, I just want to say I'm glad these did not exist when I was going to Southwest Minnesota State.
And Mr. Nathan, did you want to comment?
Just a very brief comment about your question on access to libraries. One of the things that we'll be discussing later in the session is that there are some high schools that have responded in a very constructive way, as I mentioned, to the existence of PSEO, which is marvelous. There are unfortunately some that have told kids literally you cannot use the library to take dual credit courses via PSEO, and there are parents who are prepared to come in and talk about that. We need to provide access, as you've suggested, sir, both at the high school and college level, whether youngsters choose to take a course at the high school, online, or on the college campus.
Thank you. And the chair has taken note of some of those articles in the paper covering some of those instances, and that is something that we're going to want to be taking a look at. I think we have found that this providing these opportunities for our students is something students want, parents want. It most definitely helps them with the cost of higher education. But concerns have been raised also by schools with regards to school student funding going then to institutions of higher learning and perhaps budgetary stresses that creates for high schools, and also just impacts on their student bodies if this is something where a lot of students are outside of their building for much or most of the day. And so, again, I think those are all worthy topics of discussion in this broader topic area. But I do want to come back, and if someone else has a question, please feel free. But the cost structure, and if you could provide that, and you gave us a little overview of it, the President Gores or Vice President Anderson, provide that for the committee in terms of looking at that. And I'm very pleased, and we're fortunate that we also have the chairman of the Higher Education Committee serving on this committee as well, because this is definitely an area where those two committees and interests overlap and that. But you know, given sort of the whammy we were dealt with by the Higher Learning Commission and that, with trying to provide funding now to help some of our teachers gain these credits per their directive, and that maybe was this the right time to look at raising your fee structure? And, you know, it's, and I'm sure there's never a good time to do that, but were those things that were discussed?
Yeah, Madam Chair, absolutely. And as President Gores indicated, as we began that work really over 2 years ago to look at the structures, one of the challenges that we were addressing was that there was great variability across the state. So people didn't have equal access to the same opportunities at the district level. We fully understand the pressure that puts on the K-12 system. But the reality of our analysis showed that our institutions were not breaking even on providing these programs. And we feel very strongly that they must do so, so that our current students aren't subsidizing the high school students. So we've looked at how we can keep our costs contained and really leverage across our institutions the knowledge and some of the programming. But when it comes to the costs, the direct costs to the institutions to support the faculty mentoring, the common price structure is something we feel we must move toward across the state so that those programs can be sustainable. I fear otherwise we will see institutions simply not able to continue to provide those programs if the funds aren't there. And as we look at all of our programs seeking NASEP accreditation, which is some other legislation that was passed in the last few years, that's a significant component of the quality check, if you will, and the quality expectations of the NASEP accrediting. And again, I would point out that the sequencing of the changes in price structure for the colleges is over a 5-year time frame that will begin next fiscal year. And the universities had a much smaller gap between what they were currently charging and the consistent structure. And as Dr. Gores indicated, that phase-in will be over 3 years. So we've tried to make it as workable as possible from a timing standpoint as well, so that those are incremental changes.
Okay. And either if you or Dr. Gores wants to cover, I think just as a matter of review, what's involved in terms of the faculty-teacher-mentor relationship and sort of where this expenditure goes when we authorize money for concurrent enrollment or college in the schools.
Mm-hmm. Chair Loon, I will give you a small window on that. I don't teach in the course myself, nor am I a mentor faculty member to the high school teacher, so I don't have all the different pieces to this. But it's the same course in the high school that's being taught at the university, the same course. And as such, they have all the same kinds of expectations in the classroom with the writing assignments, with all the other assignments. The mentor faculty member, university faculty of record, and the high school teacher work very, very closely together. They meet a number of times directly. There are visits to the high school. There's the support of the university faculty. There's the travel and other support to the high school when they have those meetings. They have review of the tests that they're giving, and they have a, how can I put this? They have to ensure that the quality of the students are similar in both, you know, both on at the university campus in the high school class. There's a lot of work to this that is beyond just beyond what you might expect. There's also an important component of professional development, so that again, the university faculty work with the high school faculty. At SMSU, we have workshops on our campus just for the high school faculty. Well, university faculty work with them. But they come to campus and have workshops, professional development. There is much more to this than just the, you know, what might initially appear. There are also the expenses of supporting the students, as I had mentioned, too. And there might be others as well, but this is what immediately comes to my mind.
Dr. Nathan?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, 3 points. First, there has been an assumption that, at least in some places, that college faculty are the appropriate people to be teaching high school faculty how to teach. But you heard in this room in 2015 some students who are actually recipients of this saying that they had learned more in college in the school's courses in the high school than they learned from some college faculty. I would never make generalizations. But one of the things that's worth noting is that when the high school faculty have master's degrees and a teaching certificate, they will actually have more licenses and degrees than some of the college faculty. Indeed, it was the St. Olaf president who was the chair of the board who was pushing this. The St. Olaf has on its faculty people who do not have master's degrees. And yet he was pushing this for the Higher Learning Commission, and that's a long story. 3 points here. First, there are a number of people in communities of color who signed the letter that I distributed in high schools, including some in this room, who would very much like to sit down with the Minnesota State College and University System in-state and talk about these issues of finances at the system level where these decisions have been made. And so far, despite a request several times, that opportunity has not been provided. We would like to do that. If we can't do that, obviously we would like to have a conversation with legislators about this. There are other states that do these kinds of things. We will be sharing information about how other neighboring states do these kinds of things. One of the things that you as legislators are assigned and are, in all cases, eager to do is to make the best possible use of public funds. No one draws a line around the state of Minnesota and says to Roseville School District or Eden Prairie School District or Fergus Falls, you can only buy products and services from companies that operate in Minnesota. And I think we're going to be talking, some of us, with you about some other opportunities, some other ways of doing these kinds of things from other colleges and universities in the United States, some of which are doing these kinds of things and doing these kinds of things at less cost. One other point. One key point that we have tried to make so far unsuccessfully with the senior leadership of the Minnesota State system is that the change in price has a huge differential impact in greater Minnesota, because this is a, as has been noted, a charge per mentor relationship. So if a school is offering one section, they're going to have to pay the same costs, according to materials that have been provided to us, as a school that's very large that offers five sections. And this has a huge differential impact on greater Minnesota. And the Minnesota Rural Education Association and the Center for School Change and a number of other groups have tried to have this conversation. Indeed, we did propose to have a conversation this fall with the Minnesota State, with college faculty, to talk about this. And so far, we have not been able to reach an agreement about how to do that. But the differential impact on small rural schools and on charter public schools is immense, and it's one of the things that we hope that the system would take a look at. Moreover, if a faculty member in high school has a teaching degree and a master's degree, at least in some cases, she or he might be teaching college faculty how to teach more effectively. And indeed, we have done workshops bringing together high school and college faculty where college faculty have acknowledged they've learned important things from high school faculty. So we think there's more to discuss, and we'll be coming forward with legislation for you to consider on these issues later in the session.
All right, so I've got two members on the list. We'll go to your questions, and then we need to move on to our next testifier, Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick question. Why are these mentoring sessions not delivered online via Skype? Why are we paying transportation costs and classroom costs, and it's all about seat time? That's what your testimony led me to believe. And it sounds like mentoring needs to be kind of a two-way street.
President Gores or Vice Chancellor?
Madam Chair, Representative, actually it is a two-way street, and a lot of time, so the university faculty are mentoring the high school, and there's a lot of give and take and great synergy and work that occurs. And, yes, sometimes those calls are done on Skype or FaceTime, whatever it might be. They aren't always done face-to-face, but there's great value in that university faculty member spending time also in that high school in that high school classroom. To ensure that the quality is the same, anyway, just the same value and so on and so forth, the same level, I should say. But, yes, they do that. They use electronics for sure and technology.
Representative Slocum. Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious if there's been any conversation around higher ed staff that is in the high schools needing any kind of adjustment to their licensure to adequately meet the needs of high school students.
Vice Chancellor Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm tracking the question.
So as I look through this report, you know, clearly it states 76% of these high school teachers are identified as needing some type of additional licensure or credits. I'm wondering if the reverse is also true. So as higher ed staff is going into the high schools, as they sometimes do to teach college credits or courses, is there any conversation in that direction? Do higher ed staff need special or ongoing instruction to be working with high school students?
Vice Chancellor or President Gores?
Okay.
President Gores.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative. Actually, in our professional development days on campus, and I think this happens at the other universities as well, especially those of us, not all of us have concurrent enrollment programs, but several universities do. And we offer professional development workshops for our faculty members. And as part of that, especially because we have so many concurrent enrollment arrangements, our faculty members also get professional development and information on what it's like to work with a high school student and what are the needs now, because they're different in 2017 than they were in 1984 when this started, or 1995. So it's a two-way street, and they're always learning together. That's the beauty of having the mentor-mentee relationship.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you. Just as a follow-up on that, is there a financial hardship placement on those instructors for that ongoing PD?
President Gores?
Madam Chair, it's part of their professional development as well, of the faculty's professional development, so that's built into their plans that they have to have to be university faculty.
Thank you.
It's part of their assignment,
okay.
So that's all part of it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right, Representative Juergens and Moran, can you keep it short, and then we can come back to questions, but we have one more testifier up.
Yep.
Representative Juergens.
Very brief, Madam Chair. Thank you. I just had a thought getting back to the students. Have you noticed any correlation with students that are taking your coursework in high school mm-hmm. and then choosing to attend your university upon graduation?
Vice Chancellor.
Madam Chair, Representative, we know globally at the aggregate level around 40, it's either 47 or 49%, I apologize, I don't have it exactly in my head, of the students that enroll in concurrent enrollment programs with the Minnesota State Institution go on to enroll in a Minnesota State Institution. That may not be the same one that they took the coursework from. So just under half will come to us. The other half go elsewhere.
Thank you. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I know one of the priorities in this committee is working towards closing the achievement gap, and we know one way of doing that is students going on to college and enrolling. And dual enrollment and concurrent enrollment is a great path for that, because, you know, the stats says that when they do that, they're more likely to go on to college. And, you know, been part of the finance part of education, we want to see how we can best, you know, invest in education and do it in a way that's smart. And so one of the things I know that the Council of African Heritage and others that this is really important to them. Dual enrollment, concurrent enrollment is really important. And what I heard from Mr. Nathan is that they've been trying to meet with you guys to talk about how to best move forward. Is it a place and time, you know, it's been like 6 months. Is there a place and time that you think that you can find an opportunity to meet with the group?
Yes, Chancellor.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, I think both Dr. Gores and I are certainly willing to have those conversations because we share that commitment and see the same value to the point that you're making of this is a critical strategy for us in looking at the opportunity and the success gaps.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right. Representative Moran, you good?
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you all. Like I said, we have one more testifier, but you may want to stay close just in case we finish up. If we have more questions, we'll call you down. Next, we have Todd Iverson, who is representing College Board, and that is affiliated with the AFP, or Advanced Placement Programs. I did want to note we did invite someone from International Baccalaureate, and that representative was not able to be here today, but we'll try to get them back at another time when they are able to attend. And with that, Mr. Iverson, welcome. If you'd please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Madam Chairman, committee members, my name is Todd Iverson. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the College Board. And it is with excitement that I come before you today to talk to you about the benefits that Advanced Placement brings to Minnesota students and their families. On a quick personal note, it is fun to be in front of a Minnesota committee. I spent a great deal of my career working in this place. I now represent the College Board in multiple states, but it's always fun to be back here in Minnesota and enjoy being in front of you, as well as being able to tell a really positive story about Advanced Placement in Minnesota. And I would like to start that with just a brief bit of background about the College Board. We were founded in 1900. The College Board was created to expand access to higher education. Today, many people do not understand that we are a nonprofit organization made up of 6,000 of the world's leading colleges, schools, and educational organizations. We provide multiple programs, the SAT, the PSAT, AP, which I'm here to talk about, ACCUPLACER, and CLEP. Advanced Placement is a great opportunity for students to enhance their high school education and earn college credit at the same time. It was founded in 1955. It challenges willing students to stretch themselves academically. It demonstrates to college admissions officers their eagerness to stretch themselves and to be desirable candidates. And research shows us that students who score three or higher on an AP exam are more likely to graduate from college on time, and they have the potential to save both time and money through placement and credit granting policies. Also, some recent research, students who score even the ones and twos on our AP exams are more likely to graduate from college on time. On another note, I wanted to let Representative Dabney know that we have entered in the last couple of years a new partnership with Project Lead the Way, and we have what's called AP Plus Project Lead the Way. It recognizes Project Lead the Way courses that combine well with project or with AP courses and notes that on their high school diploma as a AP Project Lead the Way student, and they've achieved, if you take two AP courses and a Project Lead the Way course, or two Project Lead the Way courses and an AP course in that same course area, it's noted as an achievement. So just wanted to let you know about that. As I've talked about, some of the real advantages is that accessing AP really challenges kids, and also one of the things I think that I want to make clear from the College Board's perspective is that I think AP several years ago got the reputation as the program that the smart kids went into, the high flyers. And I would like to challenge that myth out there. With a lot of the testing that's done today, we can identify kids that necessarily weren't great in math but do really well in history. And we believe those kids deserve access to rigorous coursework and challenging coursework, and have found that they do excel in AP courses in their area of strength. And we believe that students should have that opportunity. The College Board's Advanced Placement Program, as I said, has over a 60-year history. Our outcomes are measurable at the end of the coursework. We know, and that's why these credits are accepted at over 3,000 universities in the U.S. and nationwide, that these tests are nationally normed, they are recognized for their excellence. We have, just so you know, we have AP faculty, college faculty, AP teachers that collaborate to both design and deliver and grade these exams. They are not graded locally. They are graded regionally at readings. And so there is no bias on the grading of these exams. They are all graded equally. Wanted to make you familiar. There are 37 different AP courses offered. A fairly new AP course out there is called AP Capstone. It is a seminar course that delves into extensive research and then the writing of a research paper. We're very excited about this. It's the kind of thing that the deep thinking that a number of universities has asked us that they want to see take place. We have 5 art courses. We have English and literature composition. We have history and social science courses. We have 9 of those. We have 12 STEM courses, and we have 8 AP world languages. Specifically for Minnesota, in the May of 2016 administration, Minnesota had 46,866 AP exams that resulted in 3, 4, or 5 scores. Assuming that those students were to receive 3 credits per exam and that the average rate of a credit hour is $365, the potential savings to students and families was $51,328,112. That's from this year alone. Minnesota's commitment to AP has been longstanding. Currently, the legislature commits $3.3 million to the program, $3 million of it for test fee reductions for students, a free test for free and reduced lunch students, and a reduction for all students. There's also $375,000 available for professional development for AP teachers. The funding for AP, as I said, started a long time ago in 1992. It has been at that $3.3 million level since 2006. Just to give you an idea, we continue to grow. Last year, we gave, or 2016 administration, we gave 71,000 exams. There were 46,000 what we would call successful of attaining a 3 or higher, as I said. We continue to see growth both nationally and here in Minnesota. The growth rate nationally last year was 2.3%. Here in Minnesota, it was slightly smaller, but we continue to see good growth rate in both the number of exams taken and the success rate of students taking those exams. Just as an idea, Minnesota, approximately 66% of all the students that take those exams pass them. That is right at the top of the nation as far as their success rate, and we continue to see growth in that area. Just for your information, I wanted to put up the map. This is by legislative district, where the majority of the AP programs are. And you can kind of see up there, I will do a little bit of a pullout for you. In the metropolitan areas, it's greater. And that is one of the things that We believe there's opportunity for students, particularly in greater Minnesota, to be better served. We are going to be bringing a proposal forward to hopefully help that later in the session, and maybe focus a little attention on some rural districts that have not taken this opportunity prior to this, and look forward to working with you so that more students can access AP statewide. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have or go back over any information.
Thank you, Mr. Iverson. We do have some questions. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Iverson, for your presentation. And I'm new to the committee. What are the qualifications for a teacher to be able to teach one of the AP courses? What are their criteria?
Mr. Iverson.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, they have to be a certified teacher in Minnesota. And then they have to go through the AP syllabus approval process, which is a process where they submit the syllabus of the course that they're going to be teaching through a review process to AP. Once that is approved, they can teach the course. We highly recommend that they go to some professional development prior to that first year of teaching and at one of the AP summer seminars or workshops. We think it's very valuable. One of the ways that we are different is that there is a test at the end of this, and the student success will be judged by that test. And so we are not held to the accreditation issue that you heard about earlier. And so that is the professional development. Just to give you an idea, we have seminars that are set up at these workshops for teachers of 3 and less years experience in AP, 3 years more experience teaching AP. It's a very vigorous professional development environment. There's also a very active online AP teacher community out there that they get access to help with the mentoring that you heard about earlier. So that is our approach to ensuring quality.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so are those courses, all that preparation free to the teacher, or is there a cost to that or to the school that they teach for?
Mr. Iverson.
We do not provide the teacher workshops directly. We have partners that we work with. Carleton College is one site. The University of Minnesota is another site. Trying to remember the other one that I just saw. Maybe it might have been Augsburg. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Bethel
has another one. And then there are workshops kind of around the state as well. But they range anywhere from a cost of, for a one-day workshop, I think I saw the cost at somewhere close to $250. The two-day was $490, I think.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted some clarification. That last slide you had of the state, since I'm looking at a black and white printout, I'm just curious what those colors mean, because I think I'm in yellow. So I'm not sure if I'm good or just so-so. Average.
That's the leaves.
That's the leaves? Oh,
that's the leaves, yeah.
Okay. Mr. Iverson.
Representative Nornes, Madam Chair, Representative Nornes. The yellow would be the percent of graduates who took an AP exam would be 30 to 40% of the graduates from from that school district or from that legislative district.
Okay.
If it's yellow.
The highest?
The highest is 50% and above, and those are the green legislative districts.
Okay. Representative Norris.
No, red is lower than.
Below 10% of the graduates.
Thanks. That's all I need to know.
Other questions for Mr. Iverson? Oh, Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I really don't have a question, just a statement that advanced placement is probably the most robust course a student takes in high school. And I know from experience that the teachers who teach AP are highly regarded, very well informed, knowledgeable, impart the knowledge and skills to their students at a very high caliber because they're always wanting their students to achieve a 3, 4, or 5 on the test. The curriculum is some of the best I've ever experienced, and I'm saddened when I look across the state, although I know concurrent enrollment and PSEO are competitors, as is IB to a certain extent, but AP used to be the hallmark when former Representative Segrin was our chair. She and I did a lot of legislation together promoting advanced placement, but that was before concurrent enrollment became so popular. But we had special training, and I'm sure Representative Murphy remembers this, the money we put into training for the teachers. And the training, as I experienced it, was top-notch. And I think that we have probably not done as good a job in promoting advanced placement as we could, or maybe Mr. Iverson could do a better job of not Mr. Iverson personally, but maybe we could promote this more because it is just top caliber. And I have visited with students who have taken AP and taken concurrent enrollment, and they would put AP above concurrent enrollment just about any day.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair, I think there are people doing the AP course that knows a lot about set the structure. And that people that know about set the structure really should be green.
Thank you. And I don't recall Representative Murphy. I know Representative Erickson was an English teacher. Were you an English teacher as well?
No. No, ma'am.
But I'm guessing your sentence structure is quite good.
Well, not nearly compared to my friend, Mr. Prisha.
Your sentence structure is excellent, Madam Chair.
That's right. You do, you're the one who likes to diagram sentences.
Madam Chair, just for the committee's clarification, I don't know why we sometimes make things so difficult to understand, but just for the committee's clarification, we norm nationally with on the exams to a 3 equating to a C for a college freshman taking this test. A 4 is equated to a college freshman completing this course getting a B. And a 5 would be equated to an A. So I just, for the committee's edification, sometimes we make things more difficult than they need to be, but really as you're thinking about this, that is kind of, if a college freshman took an introductory biology course, they, based on their grade, that's what they would get on the AP exam, just so everyone's kind of understanding.
That is helpful in thinking about that. If we don't have any other questions, I did want to bring down, if we have a couple minutes, Mr. Uni, who is going to shed a little light for us on Project Lead the Way, since that question was asked. And actually, before you go, Mr. Uni, I'm going to have Mr. Walseth with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. Just wanted to clarify some of the discussion we had earlier with Vice Chancellor Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll be very brief. Sam Walseth with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. MREA was mentioned routinely in the previous presentation, so I thought I'd better chime in, although Mr. Kennedy let me off the hook for my homework today, but I find myself here. I did want to just comment and clarify that comment was made that Minnesota State is not willing to meet with MREA and others. That's not true. We have met Vice Chancellor Anderson and his staff. We did put in a meeting request on behalf of MREA and the other school organizations who are providers of concurrent enrollment to meet and discuss these issues. And we've had two meetings, and I hope still plans for a third to continue working on these issues. I'm not going to say we're, you know, satisfied or happy with the way things are. I think we find ourselves somewhere between the perspectives of Representative Scott and Representative Dabney and our frustrations and kind of questioning the why we're in this situation, but also looking at the clock and 5 years is ticking and figuring out the how and how we're going to respond and ensure that these programs, valuable programs, continue for kids. So, Madam Chair, I just wanted to clarify that we are do appreciate the conversations we've been having. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wellseth. And I think it's important that we all continue to have a lot of dialogue on this topic, because it certainly is very impactful as this committee will move forward and have to put together a budget, and certainly may have impact on Representative Nornes and his committee's work as well. So let's make sure that we're talking with each other about those things. And Mr. Uni, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Adosh Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. There were two things. One thing other than the project Lead the Way that I had communicated with Mr. Kennedy that I could speak on. Just clarification on the courses according to agreement, where the school has an individual agreement with their post-secondary institution for offering of these dual enrollment courses. MDE does not track that data. We don't collect those individual contracts. I just remembered I had actually asked that question about a year ago to staff, wondering if we could get that, and that still turns out to be the case. In terms of Project Lead the Way, if you remember in 2015, for those that are around, we kind of first had the full big exposure to Project Lead the Way, where we passed into law that a Project Lead the Way course could qualify for high school credit in math or science if it does meet the state's math or science state standards. I just talked with staff, or just communicated with staff, and for Project Lead the Way courses, if a student receives an 85% in course grade and they score a 4 or higher on the end of course Project Lead the Way exam, they're eligible to get college credit at several higher education institutes, most notably University of Minnesota, St. Cloud State, Minnesota State, Mankato, and NDSU. They can also receive credit recognition at Alex Tech, Bemidji State, Normandale, South Central College, Winona State, and St. Cloud Tech programs. I'm more than happy to provide this list to the committee as well in a follow-up. The credits are for engineering, technology, or manufacturing, but they aren't for college science or math. So that's the important difference between how we recognize it at the high school level in our it replacing a math or science class on high school transcript credits and how it translates to college credits. There's a little bit of a difference there. Our staff ballparked the kind of the credits that people receive at different institutions. We don't track it, but we've got kind of some ballpark numbers just so you kind of get an idea. So remember, these aren't exact. So about 1,100 students receive U of M credit, about 350 at St. Cloud State, 50 students at Mankato, and 50 students receive two-year institution credits. And about 200 students receive credit at NDSU per year. So that's not an insignificant amount. There's usage there between the courses in the high school setting and receiving credit at the higher education institute. So while we don't collect very technical data on college credits, we do track enrollment and availability of the Project Lead the Way courses through our Minnesota Common Course Catalog. So that's all the information I have at this moment. Again, I'll follow up with the list of higher ed institutions that offer credits and college transcript recognition for those courses at a later time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. That's really helpful. And if you could also include in that data that you send to us the high schools that are involved with Project Lead the Way, the ones that are participating.
Yes, Madam Chair, we can certainly do a run through the Common Course Catalog.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions or comments for Mr. Uni or requests for information since we have him here? All right. With that, I want to thank the committee members. Some good overviews this week. Have a nice weekend. Committee is adjourned.